This is the Multifamily Takeoff Podcast, show number 93.
And now, out of San Diego, California, streaming to listeners around the world, this is the Multifamily Takeoff Podcast, where we'll talk all aspects of anything multifamily real estate investing related, as we host a variety of guests who are active in the apartment game. Be sure to follow the show on Instagram at the Multifamily Takeoff. Now, here are your hosts, Mike Tai, Sean DeMartel, and Rich Summers.
Welcome, and listeners. I'm your host, Mike Tai. Join me today. We got our co-host, Richie Summers, fresh off a Euro trip, and we're glad to have him back.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on there, Mike. It's exciting to be back. I actually just returned, not from Europe, but from Turkey. I guess technically the Middle East, but man, it was great. Spent about 2.5 weeks out there. What a beautiful country. And the locals, the people there are freaking amazing. The food was great, but I'm excited to be back. I'm feeling focused and energized to finish this year strong, man. How are you doing?
Do well, man. I guess I got to get my continents right. Is that part of Europe, Eurasia? I know it's a generic term and people don't know. Or is that part of Asia?
Yeah, you know, it's actually technically the Middle East.
But continent-wise.
Continent-wise, yeah. You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure exactly. I had to look it up because Istanbul's right there in the in between.
Yeah, it's like, right where East meets West.
Yeah, it's like right in between Eastern Europe and like, you know, the Middle East right there. So yeah, I don't know.
Well, thankfully, we don't host a podcast on geography, but we have a great guest today who's very tech savvy. Second time on the show, Neil Bawa. Rich, can you tell the listeners a little bit about Neil?
Yeah, we had Neil on episode 19 back when the pandemic was just dropping early last year. And we decided to have him back on the show to see what he's been up to. This guy is cutting edge in terms of asset management, you know, just redevelopment projects, what he's been up to. This guy is always cutting edge. He's very well respected in the industry. If you haven't heard of him, you definitely got to tune in and learn more about this guy. He goes over a lot of insightful stuff. He talks about why he's not doing so much value add investing right now, but he's doing some ground up stuff. Very, very interesting models that I have not heard any investors speak of until this podcast. So I think everyone's going to enjoy it. As always, if you guys do enjoy our content, don't forget to drop us a 5-star review and rating on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to get discovered by new listeners, and we really do appreciate it. And without further ado, let's go ahead and bring in our guest, but not before a quick word from our show sponsor.
Are you someone who wants to get into apartment investing, but just don't have the time? Or maybe you want to receive the cash flow and tax benefits of owning cash-producing real estate, but don't want all the headaches of being a landlord. Your hosts, Mike, Sean, and Rich, have successfully teamed up with a group of senior advisors who have transacted north of 8,000 apartment units with a 100% profitable track record to form PAC 3 Capital. At PAC 3 Capital, we search for quality multifamily assets located in growing markets around the country, typically ranging from 100 to 300 units in size. Our conservative and strategic approach will ensure you, your money is working for you at the most optimal level. To obtain access to our deals or learn more, please visit www.pac3capital.com. That's P-A-C, the number 3, capital.com. Simply click the Invest With Us tab, complete our investor form, and someone from our team will reach out to you. PAC 3 Capital, strategic apartment investing.
Checking in from the Silicon Valley, San Francisco, California, Mr. Neil Bawa. Neil, welcome back on the podcast. Great to have you again.
Thanks for having me on the podcast again. Very excited to be here.
And as our listeners know who listened to the first podcast, the Silicon Valley is very fitting for what you do because you're very tech-oriented. And we discussed that a lot in the first podcast. But if you could catch us up to what you've been up to recently, maybe it's been about 12 months since we last spoke. What has gone on in Grow Capitus and in your life in the past 12 months?
Oh, it's been an incredibly busy time. We've done 7 projects since we've been on the podcast, and those total 300 million. So they're about 40 million each. All 7 are new development. Actually, no, that's not right. We did one value add, Fairview, which is in Greenville, South Carolina, fairly small one. So we haven't done one that small. It's a $15 million value add. We did that mostly to please our investors who were just screaming at us saying, you know, where's the value add? Where's the value add? You're always doing development stuff. But generally, just development and not a lot of value add. We're spinning up again on the value adds now at this point in time, but the focus remains on the development side because the market is one where sellers continue to hold sway. And in a market where sellers hold sway, I'd much rather be a seller than a buyer, if I can.
Absolutely. And when you say development, can you elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by that and why you pivoted to doing that other than just the value add market not being good? Why did you choose that particular niche?
So development essentially means building new multifamily, right? So you're building new kinds of, we build three kinds of multifamily. There's the standard apartment complex. The last one that we did was Avondale. It's a $96 million project that we raised about $16 million in equity for. It's 320 units in a very fast growing part of Phoenix. So that's an example of traditional multifamily. The second kind of project that we do is called a enterprise townhome project, where we build 120 townhomes and we sell them to 30 investors. So everyone gets their own fourplex, but it's being managed by one institutional grade manager. And then the third kind we do are non-multifamily builds. We're doing an industrial build right now in Salt Lake City. So those are kind of our three divisions on the development side. You know, the question that you asked me, which is very pertinent, is, so why did you pivot? You know, we know you're a value add guy. You love value add multifamily like everybody else. Why did you pivot? Well, number of answers. I mean, I didn't pivot because of COVID. I pivoted, you know, several years before COVID. And the reason is that I saw asset prices continuing to go up. I felt like they would continue to go up. And when asset prices go up, value add profits get squeezed. They get squeezed because essentially, you know, building that you were buying at $55,000 a door, you're now buying at $80,000. If you were buying at $80,000, now you're buying at $120,000. But the rents haven't gone up enough to match that. So you're basically buying at a lower and lower cap rate at a higher and higher price as you go. And that's inevitable because of, you know, asset inflation, because of the $7 trillion that we just injected into the world economy. That money has to go somewhere. It's searching for yield. Multifamily still appears to be a great option in terms of yield, even at the lower numbers. So, but all of that happened because of COVID. Even before COVID, though, there was a clear trend that, you know, multifamily cap rates will continue to compress. I came from development. My first project in 2003 was in development. So we have 29 employees in our company. 16 of them are just focused on development. So you have the teams, you have the dedicated software that you need on the development side, you know, tracking software, builder tracker software, all of that stuff. And then, of course, you need to have a division of people that are doing permitting and zoning. So we had that competency. And so I said, I have the ability to be a seller in a market where if the market stays stable, prices are going to go up. If something bad happens, and something bad did, COVID, then prices are going to go up much faster because they will inject so much money into the economy that that's going to balloon up the prices. So I was basically thinking, either I'm going to win or win big, and it ended up being win big. And so, you know, 3 years ago, maybe 3.5 years ago is when I started the pivot to the new development. And don't get me wrong, I love value add. I'm a value add guy. That's my true love. But I'm just a little nervous buying 70s property at 4 cap, because that's what you pay today. You know, it doesn't really matter where you are. Doesn't really matter where the property is. Unless it's in the Rust Belt, you're going to pay 4.25 cap on a 70s property. You're going to pay 4 cap on an 80s property. That's market. There's, you know, people that say that they don't pay that. I don't believe them. That's market. That's what everyone's paying. And maybe there's one-off example somewhere, but 99 out of 100 properties are selling at that rate. I can, when I build a new construction build, I build it to 7 cap, right? So when I'm done building it, I've spent the equivalent of 7 cap worth of money to build it. And then I can turn around and sell it at 4 cap. Or in Austin, my property is likely to sell for 2.95 cap when I'm done with it. So that's the current rate for that kind of asset in Austin where I'm building. So I have the arbitrage, right? As we know, even half a cap is a powerful arbitrage. To be able to arbitrage all the way from 7 to 2.95 is an astonishing amount of arbitrage that I have access to on the development side. So pivoted. And then I'm also doing what is known as extreme value add projects. And those are projects where I buy a multifamily. This is completely new. It's something that I've done in the last year and a half. And I think more people will follow me into this. So 2 years ago, Mike, if you bought a building for $80,000 a door, and that building had some land next to it, there was no justification to go out and build on that land at $100,000. And you could build at $100,000 because it's already inside of your multifamily. You know, you're going to get parking benefits. You're going to get, you know, all kinds of benefits. But if the cost of building it is $100,000 and you're buying the used price per door is $80,000, it usually doesn't make sense to build those additional units, especially given financing for them is very difficult. But today, that $80,000 a door is $20,000 a door. And the cost of construction has gone up from maybe 97 a door for internal projects only. Remember, it's much higher for external projects. But we're talking about existing land inside of your multifamily where the land is completely free. And usually there's excess parking because these properties were built in the 70s when parking requirements were much higher. So you've got plenty of parking. So you're not doing parking. You're not, you know, bringing electrical in from the street. So obviously your cost is going to be lower than if you were to build it from scratch. So now that's gone up, you know, your cost of construction has gone up maybe 13, 14%. So maybe you're building at 115 per door and you've got an existing property that's worth 120 a door. And by the time this is built, maybe it'll take 2 years to build it. This 120 a door could easily be 130 a door. So now in a property where old units are worth 130 a door, you've built brand new units at 110 a door, right? So I've done this already successfully, completed it. It massively increased my NOI, massively increased the NOI because almost all of the rents from the new building were net operating income. You know, I didn't really change anything else in the property. I didn't hire any extra people. So it was like 85, 90% NOI, which is stunning, right? Just spiked my NOI and the value of the property by $6 million. I'm selling it to myself so I can repeat the process with 36 more units. So last time I built 29 units. This time I'm going to flip it again with another set of investors and build another 36 units. So that's called extreme value add, which I think we are going to end up resorting to because we're running out of value add in the United States.
And in that model, you know, we had a meeting recently, my partners and I, and we talked about how basically exactly what you said, there aren't many value add opportunities and there's some new build opportunities. So when you do that, what does the return profile look like to your investors? Is there basically no year one returns, but you're still able to hit 2x equity multiple based on the value add upside? Or maybe a number similar.
It's much easier to hit multiples on new construction. So let me give you pros and cons. And I'm not going to be biased in favor of development here simply because I'm doing more of it now. I love value add, right? Given the choice, I'd never do development. It's too much work. For the amount of money that we make, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So a typical value add today might be positioned as, you know, 18 IRR or 20 IRR. You know, those are all Excel gimmicks. But the truth is, the average property today that you're going to do value add on, you're going to make between 14 and 15 IRR if you average it out across 100 properties. And you're only going to make 14 to 15 IRR if you sell it in 3 years, even though you're projecting 5 years. So if you look at the last 100 buildings that syndicators have sold, the average is under 3 years, right? So well under 3 years, like 2.5 years, right? So nobody, like even the most established syndicators with $5 billion portfolios, they're flipping properties in 30 months because of the cap rate compression, right? It makes sense to do it. So on the equity multiple side, what happens with, you know, my value adds, and I'm no different, by the way, so I'm not bashing anybody else. My value adds, you know, you project them at 5 years, double your money, and we're actually ending up with 2.5 years at 50% because it makes sense. And, you know, the math makes sense to sell now. What happens with development is you need those 5 years, right? You need 2.5 years to build the property, not 1 year, not 2 years, but 2.5 years to build it. You need 6 months to fill it. And then you need 2 years to grow rent. So it's really a 5-year project, whether you like it or not. So I don't know of most good development projects not hitting a 2x equity multiple. They will. And development in general has higher IRRs. So if you compare the same exact value add in the same place to a development project, so if the IRR for the value add was maybe 15 IRR, which is, you know, roughly 20% a year for investors, for those who don't know the math, then the new construction is going to be about 19 IRR, which is roughly 26, 27% annualized. But you do get those 5 years because at the end of 3 years, it's just filled. So you haven't optimized it in any way. You've got to raise rents for 2 years to really get to market because when you build a brand new building, you have 150 empty units. You're not charging market rent. No one is. You just want to fill it because you have this massive $20 million recourse construction loan to pay off. And so you're just plugging people in, right? And then the next year, you raise them halfway to market because there's still a big delta. And then the year after that, you raise them all the way to market and boom, immediately, end of fifth year, you sell the property, right? And it's often, if it's a class A, it might take even longer. Mostly I do Bs, but sometimes I'll do like a B plus. I have some class A's in Texas. So the difference that investors are beginning to understand is that when you go to development, you do get your 2x equity multiple or 2.2, 2.3. Whereas with value add, you can be very successful, and I suggest lots of investors should continue investing in value adds. It makes a lot of sense. You're getting that cash flow early, but you're most likely going to end up in a project that in 2.5 years, you'll make 45 or 50%. And then that's done. Your depreciation gets recaptured. You get to start all over again. So there's investors who don't like value add anymore because of the speed at which syndicators are flipping them. And those investors invest in my development projects. And the others are like, no, no, we're value add guys. We're going to keep investing in value add. So I think there's a market for everything. I think the value add market is significantly larger than the development market.
And with new development, you rely on two things heavily, labor and supplies. And obviously, there's a negative stigma on those two terms right now. Obviously, you're cutting edge. You always have solutions to any problems that maybe occur, and you're successfully completing these projects. How do you like to address labor and supplies, or how have you addressed it?
By going into tertiary. So I am not building. I mean, I have a few like Austin. I'm just suffering through the labor shortages by paying more. But the cap rates have dropped to 2.95, so I have the ability to simply pay extra for the labor. I can pay more than anybody else. Because when I bought the land, I was forecasting a 4.5 cap exit. Now I'm forecasting 2.95. That's about $20 million. So, you know, you got room to play there. But I mostly build in really small markets. I mean, my two favorite projects right now that are most profitable are in Idaho Falls, which is a true tertiary, and New Braunfels, which is not a true tertiary because it is 30 miles north of San Antonio, 40 miles south of Austin. So it's sandwiched. So it does have some impact, but it's definitely easier to build in New Braunfels than it is to build in San Antonio and Austin. I'm also building in San Antonio, and those projects are more impacted. The answer is don't build in the major cities because that's where most of the construction is being done. Developers tend to be overly hyper-focused on these core markets because they know that the risk is lower, but then, of course, they're really paying up for the labor. So, you know, stay away from those completely crazy markets because then your labor cost is very high. And that supply, I mean, is also on the good side, right? If you're in a place like Idaho Falls, very few people can actually afford to build what you're building. And because we have a unique methodologies to get our capital, we charge less for the product when we sell it. So we're able to basically sustain the fact that our cost of construction could be problematic if a lot of supply comes in. But if you're in smaller markets, supply is not a problem. 80% of oversupply of new construction in the US is in downtown cores. I don't build anything in downtown cores.
And the equities for these projects, are you doing a fund or are you doing a deal by deal equity raise? I know you like 506Cs typically.
We only do Cs, 506Cs. And so most of our projects are deal by deal. And then we have two different kinds of projects. The second kind is very difficult to do. I had to spend about $3 million on a marketing department to make that work. We will build 120 townhomes and as fourplexes. So there's 30 fourplexes. And we'll sell them to investors a year and a half before they're built and use their equity. So that is a 506C model. But it's as far as we know, we are the only company in the US that does it.
Yeah, I love your unique approach and the pivot you've taken in the value add, not downturn, but basically oversaturation of buyers currently, just driving up prices. We talked a little bit before we hit the record button about hybrid work. Can you elaborate on what that term means to you and maybe for our listeners?
Yeah, I think hybrid work is the single most important change in the way we are going to do real estate in the US in the next 25 years. Nothing comes close. People talk about 3D printing homes. People talk about the impact of technology. They talk about tokenization. I get all of those. But I don't think that any of those are in the same class as hybrid work. Hybrid work simply is the fact that roughly 22 million white-collar workers, well-paid white-collar workers in the US, now have brand new flexibility in the way that they work. So the US's population is about 330 million, roughly 240 million of those are adults. I'm talking about 22 million. So I'm talking about 9% of the US's population that is no longer tied to their metro. The other people still are, right? So the majority are still tied to their metro. But 9% is such an enormous number that when these 22 million people who get paid well, because they're all white-collar workers, not blue-collar, because blue-collar, really, you're tied to the work site, right? Blue-collar workers can work from anywhere, and usually they get paid a lot more. These people are now free to make decisions on where to live, regardless of where they work. And that is so astonishing. If that number was 5 million, it would impact the real estate market in a big way. It's 22 million. Some numbers put it at 40 million, but I'm going to just take the lowest number I've seen so far. 22 million Americans have now been freed from where they live, right? As far as their work is concerned, they can now live anywhere. Early adopters, about a million of these people have already moved. And they're moving, and you can imagine this, they're moving to smaller places that are nicer, they have higher quality of life. Maybe they have the kind of ethnicity that these people are looking for. Maybe they have, you know, hills, maybe they have water. Maybe they're moving closer to their relatives that they like than were traveling. But we are seeing the first 1 million to 2 million of these people move. And these are the early adopters. But the wave of people that now know they have the ability to move but haven't is 10 times larger. And these people are going to move to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. They're going to move to Asheville, North Carolina. They're going to move to Jacksonville from Miami. They're going to move from Atlanta to Destin. They're going to move to Augusta. They're going to move to so many of these true tertiary, non-connected markets in the US. And we've seen this early enough because we were already in those markets. For example, Idaho Falls is a true tertiary. How do I define a true tertiary? There isn't a big city within 100 miles. Right? Now, that's not a typical definition because, you know, when you say tertiaries, there's a different meaning. So I've coined this term true tertiary. It's like it doesn't have any anchor. There's nothing within 100 miles of it. And it's not big. It's small. Like Idaho Falls, the total metro is under 250,000. So it's not even considered a true metro, right? But it's beautiful. It has a very high number of PhDs because of that massive nuclear lab that they have. So it has the highest density of PhDs in the United States by far. Right? So the next one is Raleigh, North Carolina, where the Research Triangle Park is. And they have 1/10 of the density of PhDs that Idaho Falls has. Right? These are not things that the public knows, but we research this because we're data scientists. So when we're looking at this place, we are already seeing an impact. In the last year, home prices in Idaho Falls went up 36%. You know what that does to rents? That does 5 years of rents in a year. Right? You get 5 years of rent projections in 1 year. And they're still skyrocketing because there's plenty of room for them to grow. Because, you know, compared to what is happening in Austin right now, Idaho Falls looks horribly cheap, but it's a beautiful place to live in. It doesn't have climate issues, right? So that's why we're looking a lot at, you know, areas that don't have climate issues, because there are some of these people that are making, you know, decisions based on climate. They're not necessarily happy going to Phoenix or going to Houston, which, you know, have potential climate issues. I think that's a future problem that we haven't really seen much of. The point is, there's these true tertiary markets that are just exploding and they're just beginning a 10-year run. Remember, all we've seen so far is the early adopters move. 1 million, 2 million people. That's a very small number. I think we're going to see those 22 million people move over the next 10 years because it now makes zero sense for them to stay where they are. And that number of 22 million, I think, is going to rise over time because one of the biggest things I'm projecting is this. In the next 5 years, because of COVID, we will see amazing breakthrough technologies that will enable work from home. Because I'm an angel investor, I sit on the board of the largest startup accelerator in the US, and every other company is looking for some kind of remote work technology, from three-dimensional cameras to face mapping technologies of the sort that the iPhone has that unlocks your phone so that you can have an entire body of a person visible on Zoom. There's 100 different companies trying 100 different ideas. And if one of those works, remote work becomes much more powerful. Only one of them has to work, right? And one of those 100 companies is a little company called Apple, which is releasing a product called Apple Glass next year. They're releasing a virtual reality goggle this year, which I don't think is very compelling, but their artificial reality, you know, or augmented reality product comes out next year called Apple Glass. And I think that's a world-changing event. So 22 million people will move. That's hybrid work. It completely changes the way real estate is done in the United States over the next 5 years.
I agree with you, Neil, regarding this work from home notion and this shift that is occurring in America right now. I was recently at a multifamily conference in Atlanta about a month back called IMN, and they had this panelist of apartment owners, operators. Between them, they've owned, you know, tens of thousands of units. And they asked this panel, what is the biggest change that you foresee in the multifamily asset class 10 years from today? And one of the individuals said, we're going to the European model. He said, over in Europe right now, it's very common for 35 to 40% of apartment units to be furnished because a lot of their citizens like to work from home and bounce around and not be tied down to a specific location. And I agree that we're going to that model, myself included. This is the first time in my life where I'm not physically tied down to a location. And I'm interested in moving around and living in different cities around the country and even the world, you know. But I've noticed you mentioned something a little bit different to this model. And you said a lot of these individuals are going to choose to go to secondary and tertiary markets. For myself personally, I wouldn't live in a tertiary market because I'm single. I like to be around people. I like the energy that a city provides. So I guess my question for you is, why do you feel so many of them are going to go into tertiary markets versus primary markets?
Because developers like me are building city downtowns in those markets. There was no justification to build those downtowns in those markets before. But the extraordinary influx of people is forcing these suburban cities to create downtowns, right? So they will create vibrant downtowns. And some of them already have it, like Asheville. Asheville's a city that could be considered suburban. It's very beautiful, right? It's very nice. It's got great weather. But it's also got now a downtown core that they started building 3 years ago, and they sort of accelerated it when COVID happened. So the point is this. I think people want that downtown feel, and I think that they're going to get it. That's going to disperse. The people that want downtowns are going to disperse amongst a larger number of cities than they do now. And the kind of downtown that will become more trendy is not necessarily the one that's as dense as New York or San Francisco, but it's going to be something that is, you know, there's a word for it called suburban. Yeah. Suburban is a word that was coined, I think, by, you know, one of the consulting companies, big shifts ahead. Yeah. So when you look at suburban, right, they talk about that. The Big Shifts Ahead is, in, by the way, a phenomenal book that really needs a post-COVID update. I mean, it's like, please, for God's sake, how does everything in this book apply to a post-COVID world? Because you already had the Rosetta Stone of the shifts, but you've got to, I mean, something massive just happened. You've got to update the damn book, right? So to me, I think if you read the book, they talk about suburban. I think that that is the new urban. I think that's what's happening. And honestly, and frankly, Rich, you are not the target audience. This is a 10-year shift. It's actually people 5 and 10 years younger than you that are the audience. So audiences change over time. We think that because we want something, that people 5 and 10 years younger than us want the same thing. And the truth is, that is almost never the case. They want something a little bit different, right? So this mobility model, and I mean, Europe's a fantastic example. And the one thing that they have that we don't have is they have an extremely cheap, very fast, very convenient train system connecting their 27 Schengen countries or 29, whatever the number is now. Those Schengen countries are connected not like countries, they're connected like states, right? You have one passport and you move through the entire Eurozone and you move from place to place. I would suggest to you, Rich, I would suggest to you, Mike, that that is the way that the US was going anyway. But what would have happened in the US in 30 years is now going to accelerate over 5 because of COVID. So you're just simply getting there much faster. And we'll have, I mean, a remarkable number of people that I know that are in the, I'm a technologist, right? So I talk to lots of tech guys. They're feeling this sense of freedom that they've never felt before. And many of them have not acted on it. So for the moment, it's just they're feeling free because they can, but they haven't really taken that big step yet. So I still think that this enormous churn that we're seeing in the last 13 months is still a precursor. These are just early adopters.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we discussed one of the biggest changes that you foresee post-COVID, and Mike and I both agree with you. What is your take on today's market? Where are we at in terms of cap rates? And, you know, get out your crystal ball for a second. What do you foresee, you know, us, where do you foresee us going here in the next 2 to 3 years?
I see cap rates declining and prices increasing, very simply. There are a lot of people who would say that's not logical. Well, it is logical if you keep the fact that we are in a warped market that's becoming more warped. So I want to give you some examples just to set the groundwork for that. So the first example I want to give you is, outside the US. We now live in a world economy. We don't live in the US economy. Now, you know, we live in one place. So we're like, you know, I live in Fremont, California. But what I do in Fremont, California is affected by what, you know, is happening in China and what's happening in the UK, because the world economy is connected. And the US economy, because we're the reserve currency of the world, is the most connected economy in the world. That's one of the reasons why we have the most amount of COVID here, because there's so much travel to the US. So when we look at that, the US is an incredible bargain, right? And anyone's like, really? The US is an incredible bargain with 50-year-old properties at 4 cap? Yes. I would encourage you to spend an hour researching cap rates in Canada, the UK, Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan, and Australia.
They're all 1 and 2 caps out there, right?
Exactly. They're all floating between 1 and 2 caps. Some are 2.5, but really it's very hard to find any industrialized countries. Even most European countries are in that 3 cap range, where the United States on the day COVID started was at 5.1 cap for multifamily, 5.3 cap for student housing. And that ends at some point. We do not have a continuous run of cap rates different from the rest of the world. So that ends. Right? You were already seeing cap rates declining for 5 or 6 years. When the Fed said in 2014, we're going to start raising interest rates, cap rates didn't go up. They didn't decompress. When they raised interest rates for the first time, they didn't decompress. The second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth time the Fed raised interest rates, cap rates continued to decline. Because there's a bigger factor than interest rates. And that is the amount of money that the world is printing is accelerating well in excess of its ability to produce product, right? So more product, you know, slightly more product, way more money. And that was before we all of a sudden printed $7 trillion. 40% of the currency in circulation in the world was printed in the last 15 months. 40% of all currency in circulation was printed in the last 15 months. That money needs yield. And so it has to change yield everywhere. I mean, currently, a building, I'm not going to name it, but you know, if you want offline to talk to me, in San Antonio, not in downtown San Antonio, but in suburban San Antonio, a built-to-rent property sold for 2.95 cap. Okay? That is the world we live in today, where most brokers for new construction asset, this was a three-year-old asset, are now not even, their guidance is in the twos for new construction assets. So what has happened is for a while, people are like, oh, these older assets, they're getting more and more compressed and they're going down. But then the gap again opened up with new construction assets. Also, their cap rates going down, their prices going up. So the gap has now stabilized again. And there's enough of a gap there for both of these to continue to moving down. Another data point that I want to offer. So one is our pricing of assets in the US is actually cheaper than many, 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 many industrialized countries. The second data point is this. On January 8th, 2020, 1 month before COVID became COVID, the price of Bitcoin was $7,000 a Bitcoin. Today, it's $44,000. And it went up all the way to 60. So this is not the peak price. It's, you know, it's dropped already $16,000 from its peak. So it is 6.5 times more than it was 18 months ago. Now, it's a speculative medium. It goes up, it goes down. But I think what it does do is it reflects the fear that tens of millions of people feel about all this money printing. Mm-hmm. When people have that fear, and it's so intense that it's taken the price up 6x during a period of such volatility. When people feel that fear, they don't just buy Bitcoin. They buy every asset that's fixed. And real estate is one of them. And so is gold. You know, gold reached a record high price, I think 1900 an ounce. So what we're seeing is there's a clear movement of people buying fixed assets. And if Bitcoin can go up 6.5 times and real estate went up 40%, one would argue that at least in a post-COVID environment, real estate is not as inflated as Bitcoin is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was just traveling in Turkey. And their Turkish lira out there, which is their currency, was trading for about 8 Turkish lira to 1 US dollar. But just 2 years ago, it was about 2.5 Turkish lira to 1 US dollar. So even though we've been printing a ton of US dollars in our local economy and devaluing our currency, it's still the gold standard amongst the world. And so if I'm hearing you correctly, as long as we're still the gold standard and other countries still want to place capital into our economy, we're still going to be sitting pretty good and the fundamentals look pretty decent. Would you agree with that?
I don't know that the fundamentals look pretty decent. I just don't see an alternative to money printing at this point of time. We're in this cycle that ends with one massive hyperinflation bust like Zimbabwe. But the amount of time it takes to get to that bust is much greater than most people think. And now people are realizing it. So there's a guy named Simon Black. He runs a website called Sovereign Man, and he always guides people to leave the US, and, you know, get another passport, go live somewhere else. I was watching his latest podcast, and he says, you know, I acknowledge the fact that I thought that in 2008, this whole system would crash, and they printed more money and it recovered. Then when COVID happened, I thought it would crash, and they printed more money and it recovered. I'm beginning to realize that the extent to which you can pretend and extend is pretty radical. You can pretend and extend for a long time, and Japan's a perfect example of that. They started, you know, massive money printing in 1989. And since then, for the last 32 years, people have been saying, this is the end of the Japanese economy. No such thing has happened. Right? They haven't had much growth because they slowed growth because of money printing. And I think we're going to slow our growth too. But I don't think that that's an alternative to money printing. So, you know, Japan, 30 years, they're continuing to go and they're not the reserve currency of the world. They don't have the kind of innovation that's going on in the US. Keep in mind that we all love to beat the US, and the fact that China is catching up is all right. But when I look at AI, artificial intelligence, clearly the next massive tech boom, it's all happening in the US. When I look at the bio boom, which will make us near, you know, have 100 plus year lives, it's happening in the US. So when I'm looking at the new booms, they're all happening in the US. Self-driving, clearly I saw the new Tesla release. It's phenomenal. That's happening in the US. So from a technology perspective, we've got a significant lead at this point in time. And I'm not seeing that technology lead shrink. I don't think Europe's doing as well as us. And their cap rates are still in the twos. And our cap rates are still in the fives. And I think multifamily is now going to drop to 4, 4.5 within the next few months. So there's a lot of reasons to say multifamily prices can't go up. But when you look at it from a macroeconomic perspective, I don't find any reasons why they would not go up. And a lot of people are like, well, yeah, but you're in the trade, so you're going to say good things about this. Actually, no, I have a track record. Go find me on the web. I have a track record of saying they won't go up, they'll go down. The question is, when multiple times I said this and multiple times I was proven wrong, I went and researched, what is it that is causing these prices to continue to go up even as rates go up? And the answer is there's more here than what we see in front of us. There's a world economy that's exerting pressures on prices to continue going up.
And you were talking about this like nomad culture that is kind of developing or is going to develop over the next 10 years where people want to live in these tertiary markets. How do you see that affecting core coastal MSAs such as San Francisco?
I think the impact will be significant, but I don't think that it will be quick. I think that those markets will adjust and adapt. Those markets will make necessary changes. I think that you're going to see population growth in the San Francisco Bay Area flatten out, in Los Angeles flatten out. It'll flatten out New York and Miami and lots of these places. They'll have flat growth. And you might think, well, flat growth is something that's unacceptable. Not really. I mean, Cincinnati has flat growth. So does Philadelphia. So does Cleveland. That doesn't prevent these cities from making money in real estate, right? They're actually, you know, Philadelphia, Cincinnati, Cleveland are actually some of the best places to make money today, even though they're part of the Rust Belt. My point is that you're going to see growth flatten out in a lot of these markets. I just don't think that there's a plunge that happens in the short run. And by short run, I mean the next 10 years. So I think that those markets were already less attractive than Phoenix, Austin, you know, Orlando, Nashville. They were already less attractive, and now they're going to become even lesser attractive. So what will happen is, you know, the cap rates in those markets are in the twos and threes. And what I think is the rest of the US will catch up to them. What I don't anticipate is that those markets are going, you know, the cap rates are going to go from 2 and 3 to 5. I don't think that happens. There's a lot of people that love those markets. There's a lot of great jobs in those markets. And I don't think that that changes in the short run.
Do you feel like you know, hyperinflation and maybe the Fed one day realizing that the inflation has gotten away from them to a certain degree is a risk to us? Because I know, you know, if you look at like the housing market, I think Redfin just put out an article recently that said the U.S. housing market as a nation is up 16% from this time last year, which is a pretty significant jump. And so do you think that might be a threat to our economy, is that the Fed realizing that the inflation has gotten away from us and then them knee-jerkly raising interest rates?
Yeah, I think so. I do think that the Fed at this point of time is going to face some pressure in terms of, you know, the inflation basically was supposed to be a transitory thing. It doesn't look transitory. It's still running, you know, very hot. I think that they will raise interest rates next year. My question is, when they raised interest rates five times in the 2016 to 2019 cycle, what impact did you see in real estate? I think it's when they raise it 10 times, mm-hmm. at some point, obviously, the impact is more significant. So I think what you saw there was a moderation in the market. Rent growth in 2018-19 dropped all the way to 1.5%. It was 6% in 2014-15. So it dropped from 6 to 1.5 is a big drop in rent growth, you know, and cap rates, which were continuously going downwards from 2012 onwards, by 18-19, they were just flat. They were flat. They weren't increasing. They weren't decreasing. I mean, the 2 years before COVID, cap rates are a straight line. Now they're compressing again because of all this extra money. And I think that they're going to, you know, once we get to the interest rate hikes, I think there's going to be a flattening effect. Rents are going to slow. They have to slow. I mean, they're crazy fast right now. They have to slow at some point. So I think a moderation effect is quite likely.
Okay. What do you think, in your estimation, is the biggest risk to multifamily moving forward?
At this point, it's a bigger black swan event. So to me, I think the nature of our world accelerates black swan events. So we are used to black swan events coming once every 20 or 25 years. We had the oil crisis in the late 70s and early 80s. We had 9/11 in 2001. We had 2008. And now we've got 2020. So if you look at the last three, they've come in the last 20 years. And I think that that is going to be about our average. So black swan events in a world like us come more often. And a lot of that has to do with technology, but a lot of that also has to do with interconnectedness. Interconnectedness amplifies black swan events. So I think the biggest risk is a black swan event. Otherwise, I think we have three very good years ahead of us.
Neil, I was wondering, you pivoted basically from value-add multifamily, which GrowCapital is focused on heavily, to new development in industrial and multifamily. When you decided to make that pivot, I'm curious, fundamentally, did you guys just educate yourself on the matter throughout your network, or did you partner with someone who's already best in class on those projects to assist you and to help you grow and learn, you know, on those tasks or in completing those tasks?
Right. So we knew we wanted to become a developer ourselves. And so we went through that education process, the process of hiring staff. So we have a director of development, we have a, you know, development associates, we have two people basically in the land pipeline. So we've got zoning folks. It took us a good 2.5 years to hire, train, and make those people efficient. And during that 2.5 years, we were working with developers that, you know, were out there that wanted to work with us. And we have the largest equity pipeline for developers in the United States. So we were helping them and also learning. I think that's a very typical process. So we were 50-50 partners in a lot of projects with developers.
Interesting. So I've heard you say before, Neil, that you believe the fourplex is actually the best investment that you could make as an investor. What are the reasons behind that? And then maybe jump into a little bit of the logistics and the reasons you went into this fourplex model where you're building a ground up fourplexes, you're stabilizing these communities, and then you're selling them individually to investors.
Sure. I think that the fourplex is the best of all worlds. We in multifamily talk about scale. We in multifamily talk about the fact that you've got institutional property managers, not Joe Schmo property manager. These are property managers managing 30,000 units and 50,000 units. And so there's all those benefits of multifamily. But what we don't talk about enough, because it's not to our benefit, is we don't talk about the bad sides of multifamily. Number one, you've got 10-year rate locks. And most multifamilies are purchased on bridge loans. So something bad happens, you're stuck. Whereas fourplexes, you get 30-year, 3%, 4% loans that are locked forever. You know, we've had so many projects. I've had a project that didn't do well. It should have exited at 22%. It exited at 12% because our loan defeasement was $2.5 million on the day of exit because COVID happened and interest rates dropped. When they dropped, the defeasement increases. So it jumped up by $1.5 million. And so we went from making 22% to making 12%. We don't talk about that, but that's a problem. Where if it's fourplexes, because it's a single family product, you're basically getting these 30-year Fannie Freddie loans and you're getting leverage at 70, 75, even 80% leverage, and nobody really worries about that. So there's that leverage piece, and there's also liquidity. When somebody owns a fourplex, they get cancer in the family and somebody doesn't have insurance, they can sell that fourplex the next day. It actually takes, on average, you know, if you're in the middle of a five-year project, you have 2.5 years before your money can come back. So multifamily is illiquid. Fourplexes are completely liquid. In fact, they are the most treasured asset class in the US, not single family, fourplexes, because people want that scale. Now, what was missing from fourplexes that is unique to Grow Capitalist is that institutional management. If I have a fourplex, I cannot convince SMP management, which manages 50,000 units, to manage it. They're like, no, not our model. So what I had to find was, I love the fourplex model. It has so many things, so many advantages over multifamily. The problem is I can't convince a high-end property manager to manage it. The answer was actually pretty simple. They'll happily manage it if I can build 30 fourplexes in one project, because they're seeing a 120-unit townhome facility where they've got an on-site property manager, a swimming pool, a clubhouse. To them, it's just a class A 120-unit project. So I started basically building them at 120 units with each investor owning a fourplex. And now that investor has institutional grade property managers with institutional grade reporting and property management software. You know, I can fire the property manager and find another institutional property manager. No big deal, right? Just like we do with multifamily. So they get it, but they get something that's very valuable. They get their loan locks, and then they get something that's extraordinarily valuable. We talk about depreciation in multifamily, right? So we talk about the fact that invest 100,000 and I'll immediately give you a negative 75,000 paper loss. Isn't that awesome, right? Even sometimes I'll give you $100,000 paper loss. Yes, but how many times have you heard people say, and by the way, 3 years later when I sell the building, I'll take that loss back because it's recaptured, right? Depreciation is not a tax benefit. Everybody who says depreciation is a tax benefit doesn't know what they're talking about. It is a tax deferral. It's a deferral. You're pushing your taxation into the future. So you're going to recapture it, right? But what if you own a fourplex? Well, the investors ask me, what is the ideal time to hold a fourplex? My answer is very straightforward. Until you die. Because the day you die, the basis and all of the equity in that fourplex will adjust in something known as step-up basis, and your kids will get it, and they won't have to pay any tax. And let's say you don't die for 30 years. Mike, you're a young guy. You have a fourplex. You hold it for 30 years. You get 30 years of depreciation not captured ever, right? It's not recaptured. You're just claiming it every single year. You can either do bonus depreciation, get it all in 1 year, or you can do straight line depreciation. Now you have 27 and a half years of depreciation from one purchase. If it's syndications that last 3 years, you'd have to do 9 syndications to get the same benefit. And you have to line them up so that your new syndication came in exactly at the same time as the old one exiting, so that you didn't end up with that money getting recaptured. That's a huge benefit. That is an enormous benefit. I mean, that depreciation essentially makes your cash flow free or tax-free for at least a decade. And then after that, it's lightly taxed. People don't talk about it. I mean, and I didn't talk about it when I was a multifamily guy, but I eventually discovered that there was a better asset class. But that asset class was not interesting to me until I could make it institutional and give it scale. And that's why I don't build less than 100 townhomes.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
This is an interesting model, and this is the first I've actually heard of someone executing it in the manner that you are. When you go and build these fourplexes, right, you do 120 units and you sell them off 4 at a time to individual investors. How do you guys do the repair, maintenance, and all that, the CapEx, that sort of stuff? Is there an HOA in place?
There's an HOA and a property manager. I mean, there's on-site property management, there's maintenance. So one of the biggest benefit that they get, like if you were to, Rich is going to go out and buy a fourplex in Cleveland, the big problem is that property manager doesn't have a, you know.
Mike owns a fourplex in Cleveland, actually. So that's the real life example.
Perfect example, right? So if you have that fourplex in Cleveland, you've got the scale compared to the one unit. So you're much better off. And you know this already. And you've got the 30-year interest rate lock if that's important to you. So you've got two benefits. The third benefit you don't have, because every time somebody comes to repair it, you're going to get charged somewhere between $55 and $125 an hour. Whereas when you have a fourplex in one of my communities, I am paying my maintenance guy $22 an hour.
Right.
Right. And his job is to keep running around the property. And the only thing that that has to be had is attribution so that, you know, that bill goes directly to Rich and doesn't go to somebody else. But that's easy enough, right? Every time in an enterprise multifamily, every time you go and repair something in unit number 51, you go put it in the property management software. You say, in 51, I repaired this. So you basically, the property manager bills that directly to that owner, right?
Yeah.
And you now get 30 different owners receiving reports every month or every quarter, as opposed to one owner. So it's completely, you've got the benefits of individual ownership with all of the benefits of scale without any compromises.
That's such a unique model. So you're getting the upside of residential with the upside that you get with the multifamily on the expense side of things, having that on-site staff. And I'm guessing maybe even is the leasing fee a little bit cheaper, not the leasing fee, but the management fee. Do you get the economies of scale
way
with that?
Cheaper. Oh yeah. 3.5%, right? So, so we're paying 3.5% plus staff. It usually comes out to about 8%. So people are like, yeah, but I pay 8% on my fourplex. The answer is really you have people on site. We've got people on site. So our maintenance expenses are much lower and our leasing velocity is much higher because you have a leasing manager dedicated to a 100 unit community. They work there all day, right? So, you know, by the time you take the payroll expense and you combine it with the 3.5% that property managers charge, it does come out to 8%, but you get a lot more for that 8%.
And having on-site staff, as you know, impacts the LASL process so much greater. Yep. Your conversions are exponentially increased, where when there's people offsite, them doing showings and trying to get that place leased up, it'll sit vacant for 2 months at a time, your properties, when there's offsite management, which is unacceptable.
Right. And you've got a piece of land that you own 100% fee simple, but you've got a pool, but you've got the gym, you've got the dog run. So the amenities that a single family or a fourplex can never have are completely provided to you.
Mm-hmm. How are you, from again an operator standpoint, Neil, how are you funding these deals? Kind of walk us through the timeline. What does this timeline look like for an investor?
So basically, you have to have a very large number of rich investors because they are giving me 20 to 30% of the down payment before I build them. And I need to have a very large bank account because it doesn't work if you don't have a shovel-ready project, but it takes me 1 year and about $1 million to get the project to shovel-ready, and that million is mine. So the risk that I'm taking in the first year is exponential because unlike other developer projects where they bring in some equity early on and then they use that equity to do all of the zoning, permitting, shovel-ready stuff, architectural design work, I can't do that. Because I'm selling units to somebody. I can't sell units to somebody and force them to pay equity to me up front. So I have to wait until it's shovel ready before I go to investors. So there's, an upfront $1 million that has to be spent on each project.
And that's coming from Grow Capital. So your pocket, essentially.
It's coming directly from my pocket. Yeah.
Okay.
So, gotcha. I mean, you need to have a lot of staff. So development is extraordinarily staff heavy because there's so much that goes on in the permitting and zoning process that you simply can't. It's not like property management. I mean, Mike buys a building and then has a great property manager, and that property manager is busting their butt. So they're doing thousands of activities for Mike, the investor, Mike, the syndicator. None of those happen for development. So you need all of those staff to do thousands of activities. Right. So we have custom software that is available in the development side that is the equivalent of property management, but it's designed for you to do development. And it's expensive. It's way more expensive than, let's say, AppFolio.
Okay. So the first year, you're about $1 million in the red and you got your permits, all that sort of stuff per project.
Yeah.
And then what's next after that?
We bring in equity from the investors. Their down payment funds the actual construction.
Okay.
They are getting a delta on the cap rate, right? So if I was selling the product today and it was completed and it was rented, I'd sell it sub 4 cap. And they might be getting it for 5 cap. The delta on a year, they're making an enormous return on that equity.
Okay. And so then once this project is completed, are you leasing up these units and then the transaction happens and the investors are getting the lending to purchase these fourplexes?
We provide the lending, we provide the tenants, the property transfers on the day that all four units are rented.
Wow.
And, okay. And you're using a typical Fannie Freddie residential loan. You're not going like, you're not grouping them together or doing a portfolio loan of some sort?
No, it just Fannie Freddie or some of 80, 90% of our clients use Fannie Freddie loans, just, you know, regular loans.
That's right.
And then 10% use commercial loans.
Gotcha.
So those, you know, those that don't have a W-2 income, those that can't really qualify for a Fannie Freddie loan, they use commercial loans. And usually the commercial loan in most cases is from the same bank that did the construction loan.
Outstanding.
What are these fourplexes generally costing the investor? And then what kind of returns can they roughly expect? Just ballpark.
18-19% annualized, 15 IRR, something in that range, but they get to keep it forever.
Great.
So that IRR goes up over time, right?
Yeah,
so that's a 10-year IRR. When we project the 30-year IRR, it destroys every project we've ever done, just completely crushes it. So on a 30-year IRR, no product in the United States that I know of could come close to a managed fourplex. We call them managed fourplexes because they are inside an institutional grade community that has amenities. Because amenities bump up the rent a lot. They bump up the lease rate a lot. So managed, you know, fourplexes, I have not seen any product. And I can tell you, I mean, I've looked at dozens of products just for my personal investing. I've invested millions of dollars into different things. I've never seen anything like a managed fourplex. So we tend to focus more on it. I mean, it doesn't mean that I'm not building value, not doing value add or building apartment complexes. Of course, we continue to do those because, I mean, there's only so many people that will buy these, right? I mean, you know, 30% on $1.4 million is our typical price. Is 350,000, 400,000. Well, 30% is about 420,000 down, right?
Yeah.
So you need 20 times as many investors.
Wow. Hey, Neil, I wanted to switch gears here for a little bit as we're winding down the show. I wanted to ask you what your take was on short-term vacation rentals, if you have any experience with them. I know COVID has, you know, brought a bunch of changes to the marketplace and changed the way people that want to travel. We're seeing hotels kind of take a little bit of a hit in certain markets, but it seems like short-term vacation rentals are becoming more and more trendier, especially with these younger millennials. And I wanted to get your take on it. What is your experience with them?
That was a very saturated market, and COVID has given it a new lease of life. So I think that, you know, people keep saying, oh, the moment international travel returns or the moment COVID goes away, everybody's going to go back. No, that's not the way the human psyche works. The first time in human history, 7 billion people were affected at the same time, 7 billion minds were affected. It doesn't snap back. That's not how things work in the psyche. Airbnb is just more attractive. People are just more interested in shorter staycations. So I think Airbnb basically got a big boost. How long it lasts, kind of hard to tell. That is a very expensive market. But I certainly think it's more attractive today than it was 18 months ago.
Awesome, Neil. Well, let's wrap things up. Thanks for joining us. You've been outstanding. You definitely did not disappoint. Tell the Multifamily Takeoff listeners how they can get in touch with you or just Grow Capitas.
Well, the easiest way to get in touch with me is to Google my name. I'm the only Neil Bawa on the internet. So just type in N-E-A-L space B-A-W-A, hit enter. You'll see all of my projects. You'll see my websites. You'll see multifamilyu.com, or that's multifamily followed by the letter u.com, where we do 20 deep dive webinars a year. About 30,000 people attend those. We actually have the largest webinar presence in the multifamily industry. So we've had as many as 800 people attend webinars. And they're a deep dive. They're very interesting. They're content that we like. So there's stuff in there that you would not typically see, like the 20-year impact of climate change on real estate, stuff like that, that just catches our fancy. So we do these webinars. We have more investors than we know what to do with at this point. So product is really our challenge. But we hold the webinars because they're so much fun.
And I can provide a testimonial. I actually subscribe to Neil's email server, and he does provide some valuable content, and the webinars are great. But in conclusion, Neil, you were great today. And on behalf of myself, Rich Summers, we're the Multifamily Takeoff Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Multifamily Takeoff Podcast. For more information regarding anything multifamily real estate investing related, or if you would like to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, visit themultifamilytakeoff.com. And be sure to follow the show on Instagram @themultifamilytakeoff. See you next week.